call for Linnell versus Cone. Morning.
Morning, Your Honor.
Okay. And have you both signed in?
Yes, sir.
Yes.
Okay. Let me just give her a chance, Mr. Greenspan, to get
it. Give me just a second.
Sure. Take your time.
Wake my computer.
Mr. Greenspan, how much time would you like to reserve for rebuttal?
5 minutes, please.
All righty. You may begin whenever you're ready.
Great. Thank you. May it please the court, first, thank you for adjusting the order here so I only have some judges mad at me today instead of all judges. I do appreciate that. On behalf of Mr. Linnell, we would suggest strongly that there was a failure of evidence in this case to for the jury to have found him guilty of involuntary manslaughter. This is an interesting case. Virginia doesn't have a castle doctrine, so to speak, for example, such as Florida. But on the other hand, Mr. Linnell was in his house. He had the doors locked. The deadbolt was there. It's all set out, I think, in detail in the brief. And this fella comes breaking in the door, literally. Mr. Linnell arms himself as he has a right to do. He's in his house properly and legally. When he sees the violence put on the door, he loads. Only then does he load the rifle, and then this fellow's coming down the steps.
As to the self-defense, in order to get a self-defense instruction, doesn't there have to be some evidence from the defendant indicating that he or she felt endangered?
Sure there does, yes. I would agree with that proposition. I don't think...
Is yep. that lacking in this case?
I don't believe so. When you look at the total circumstances, and this was a direct and circumstantial evidence case, mostly circumstantial. When you look at the total circumstances, Mr. Linnell, in his statement to Officer Neal right at the scene and then his lengthy statement to the detectives, certainly made it appear that he was in a defensive situation. He came upstairs. The rifle wasn't loaded at that point. It's not until he saw the
violence.
But
Mr. Greenspan, didn't he indicate that he was not fearful at the time that the event occurred and that essentially he was, quote-unquote, raging?
Well, I think you have to look at, and I don't know if the court's had the opportunity, it's 2.5 hours, but when you look at and see the statement, review the transcript of it, but see it, and the manner, and take that in conjunction with his initial statements, which I think are really important because those are the ones that are spontaneous. They're very close in time. Officer says to him, you know, what happened, and he describes it and says that he didn't mean for it to happen. He describes, you can hear it in his voice.
Self-defense is an intentional shooting. You intend to shoot somebody to keep them from doing you harm. This was not an intentional act. This was, according to the defendant anyway, an accident. And the jury so found.
Well, but the jury was entitled to receive, and the authorities are cited under the Foster and other cases, to be able to be instructed on both theories, accident and self-defense. That's the sentence.
But in order to give the jury instruction, there has to be the scintilla. And I think what Judge Petty is indicating is that while that may be true that you can offer different theories to the jury, if there's a legal conflict, there's nothing to support the instruction.
Well, there is. There's statements attributed to Mr. Linnell in the interrogation questioning that he fired. He gives a variety of statements sort of in a conversational sense, but that he fired not aiming for his leg, but he fired intentionally the rifle.
But how is that self-defense if he's not actually aiming at the person? Are you indicating that...
Well, you don't have to be a good shot. You don't have to intend to hit the person. You can be intending to act in this manner, firing the rifle, in order to scare him off or to back him off or to slow him down. Remember, he's coming down the steps at him at
but
that
point.
But
there's no proof of the fact that he's coming down the steps.
Yes. I can go through that pretty quickly, I think.
Well, the expert actually indicates that he can't determine whether he's advancing or not. He just simply says he's not at the top of the steps. You've got statements during your argument to the court that he's, in fact, advancing, but Mr. Linnell doesn't say that either.
Actually, Mr. Linnell was wrong. That's why I say you have to look at the total circumstances. He thought at the moment, as he's describing it, that he was up at the top of the steps. That's impossible because the bullet goes into the ledge at the top of the steps. So that'd be an impossibility for him to be at the top of the steps. I believe, and it is clear from the blood spatter, spray of blood, brain matter material, or leg matter materials, that's all in the middle step area. And in the manner of how he was shot, his left leg would have been lower in order for the bullet trajectory
to go into
his right
thigh.
Where
is that in the record, aside from supposition? Where is that presented, that his leg was coming down or moving, other than argument that you made?
Well, that's what the physical evidence is because of the location.
Wasn't that your estimation of what the physical evidence suggested as opposed to what the firearms expert testified to or Mr. Linnow testified to?
Well, the firearms expert really was only called with regard to the working capabilities of the rifle and the nature of this lever action rifle. If you go to Crime Scene Detective Kiesling's...
I'm sorry, I meant Detective Kiesling.
Oh, okay. When you go to his, essentially his cross-examination, first of all, you'll see that he noted at some point, well, I don't know, anything could happen. So there is very much a nature of Kiesling's testimony to look at. And he gave no consideration in evaluating the evidence to the location of this spatter and so on, where the bullet hole was, the nature of where the wounds were to the body per the medical examiner's testimony.
Do you agree that involuntary manslaughter, which is the offense you argued he should be convicted of, and ultimately you prevailed, involuntary manslaughter, that defense, I guess it is a defense to murder, and self-defense are inconsistent theories, inconsistent defenses.
Judge, I objected to the waterfall instruction that this was a second-degree murder prosecution. We objected to the voluntary and involuntary manslaughter instructions.
You didn't object to the involuntary manslaughter objection.
I believe that we did. We objected.
Well, I'm looking at page 861 of the appendix, and you specifically say that you're arguing that there's no evidence of malice, and then you say, Ms. Pavelchuk compels me to ask the court to reconsider the motion to strike. She has just conceded the malice and the heat of passion issue. She gets involuntary manslaughter, and that's it. That seems to me like you're agreeing that an involuntary manslaughter instruction was appropriate.
First of all, I noticed that the other day in preparing for this argument. If you go to my statement there, it's that Your Honor should strike the second-degree murder and the involuntary manslaughter charges because of what she said.
I think as I read that, I see that as being a misprint.
So that's what I was just going to say. It's either I misspoke or it's a misprint
that should have been voluntary manslaughter.
That's right. And that this jury should just be instructed on involuntary manslaughter. That's from an instruction point of view. That's not a concession. And I think throughout the instructions, I said, as far as form is concerned, I'm not objecting, but as far as the submission.
That's your motion to strike. Where you're renewing your motion to strike, I believe.
Judge, that was during the 861 is during the instructions, I believe.
Okay, I stand corrected. I see I do have the wrong page here.
I want to ask a question about the inconsistencies in the testimony by Mr. Linnow regarding his state of mind when he shot the victim in this case. Let's just take a couple of simple examples. The raging. I was raging. All right, you have this intense of a... Your view is that if you look at it in time-wise, it's not so inconsistent. But let me just say that there is the idea that he was afraid, and I think there is some testimony to that effect, and there's also circumstantial evidence, but there's also the fact that he clearly, 2-3 times, said, I was raging at the time. Now, the question is, with respect to the jury instruction, with that kind of inconsistency in the record, some of which would support a self-defense and some of it doesn't, tell me what the legal requirements for the trial judge are in order to determine what to do. Because I think maybe I haven't been on the trial bench more frequently of late, but I'm concerned about what appear to be both evidence in favor of your instruction, for example, on self-defense, and some against. Tell me what the trial judge should have done.
So when
you think there was anything incorrectly done, especially?
Well, incorrectly. I disagree with the result.
I mean, in terms of taking it from a legal analysis as to how do I decide if there is a scintilla of evidence when I have evidence going in two different directions.
So, may I continue?
Yes, sir. Go ahead.
By your statement, Judge Nunziata, there is a scintilla of evidence. There are statements that circumstantially, if not direct, or I was afraid, I didn't know what was going on, this guy was in this position.
Is that enough when there is something to the contrary?
That's a scintilla of evidence. And the jury, the arbiters of the facts, had the right to address it just like you did.
Does the court make a credibility determination?
I believe that's what the court was doing. No, the court must not make... Not at this standard, not from an instruction point of view, because...
That's the one question I have, and perhaps the Commonwealth can address it as well. I have a sense, I can't tell you I have anything more than that, that there was weighing and credibility determinations made with respect to what the jury instruction should be. Tell me how, if I wanted to go that route analytically here, tell me how you would support that conclusion. Because I'm sure the Commonwealth's going to give me the other.
Well, interestingly, the judge at the second motion to strike stage took a recess and came back on the bench on the murder instruction and said, I find that there's a scintilla of evidence, even though it was highly disputed. And so in this instance, the judge, I believe, was making a credibility determination. By the total nature of it, she was, Judge Ascarati was essentially saying that because Meenow in his questioning by the police officers didn't say, this was self-defense, I was defending myself, or he was within a foot grabbing my neck grabbing me by the throat, or something like that. When you look at a circumstantial case, you're looking at evidence that the jury could credit to a particular theory. And here there was certainly, it's a break-in, it's a violent break-in through the double lock and so on. You know what the facts are, and this man is coming, is within feet. Even if not coming, there's not a statement of his motion, he's within feet.
I'm going to interrupt you and I apologize, but for me it's how does the judge pick the segments that support the defense's instruction rather or the reverse.
Judge,
because there are two ways it could have gone, the judge,
right.
Court. On what can the judge disregard your evidence because there's also evidence of raging?
I think
malice?
That is exactly what a trial is to determine, and in
but
this
how?
Case
how do you pick?
I don't think the judge gets to pick.
Okay,
if there is
there,
evidence of self-defense. And
I'm getting you to use your time, and I'm sorry.
Okay,
but
Mr.
Right.
Greenspan, I'm going to put 2 minutes back on your time.
Okay, thank you.
Stephanie, good morning.
Good morning. Catherine Adelfio on behalf of the Commonwealth.
I'm going to start with that question, if only because I'm trouble that I have the question, in all candor. There is evidence that one could point to of self-defense. It is countered by other evidence that suggests maybe not. But isn't that for the jury to decide?
Your Honor, I'd suggest that at the time Mr. Leno pulled the trigger, either accidentally or in a rage, there was no...
No evidence at all?
No evidence that he had bare fear of bodily injury. There was no evidence that Mr. Leno was taking any overt action towards him. Yes, it's true that at the time, Leno...
He testified, didn't he? A bit?
He did never testified.
Coming toward him.
Yeah. He never testified that he was afraid.
Ms. Adelphi, let me challenge you, though, on that. Suppose... that he had not testified in this case. And suppose the evidence was that the victim broke into the house just like he did and there was evidence that the defendant, grabbed his gun, came up, and shot him. Wouldn't that, just those facts themselves, the fact that this victim broke into the house, wouldn't that warrant a self-defense instruction?
Your Honor, I'd suggest that if the perpetrator was not actively moving toward a homeowner or a resident, then no, you can't shoot someone.
That seems to me to be the classic self-defense. Somebody broke into your home, and they were, loud and threatening. I mean, just the fact somebody broke into your home.
But, Your Honor, I'd suggest in this case that, I would say that you, if you aren't in bodily fear and you don't have the bare fear of
doesn't the fact that somebody broke into your home effectively impute? I mean, the reasonable inferences one draws from that.
I think that there's a number of situations where it would not, Your Honor.
Mr. Lino armed himself when he realized somebody had broken into his home in a pretty violent way. The door was coming off its structure, if you will, even through the bolt, the deadbolt lock. It could be seen as frightening. Without determining the validity, accuracy, and weight to be given to it, I'm only focused on the jury instruction, and who knows how a jury might have taken it. But a scintilla of evidence is a tiny bit. It's pretty small.
Your Honor, I'd like to focus, though, on the time when the shot was actually fired. Okay. Perhaps not knowing who is in your home, perhaps it's appropriate to arm yourself. But in this case, Leno knew it was the victim.
Well, he didn't know that, counsel, until he actually got upstairs. When he initially heard the footsteps, he wasn't aware of who it was.
There's no evidence that he didn't know who it was, and
he acknowledges to the police detectives only when he gets upstairs does he realize that it probably is the victim.
And at that point, that's when he loads the shotgun. And he doesn't load the shotgun because he's afraid of the victim. There's no evidence that he loaded the shotgun because he was afraid.
Circumstantial.
Well, but isn't an inference? I mean, the inference that you draw, one does not load a gun and confront somebody breaking into their house unless they're afraid of that person. That's the inference.
Or you're very angry, and that is what the evidence in this case shows, was that he was very angry. But
we're not talking about the ultimate conclusion. We're talking about a scintilla of evidence. And the evidence can be in conflict, but if there's a scintilla of evidence that the defendant was being threatened, that then requires the judge to instruct the jury.
Well, Your Honor, I'd suggest in this case, at the time that he brandished the gun at the victim, there was no evidence that he had any bare fear of bodily harm.
But if there were some evidence, if someone could, even by inference, there are inferences that can be drawn, even from the initial circumstance that we are describing with the breaking of the house. And if one is enraged, doesn't mean he's not afraid.
But there was certainly no evidence that he was afraid. He never suggested that at the time that...
The gun, to me, speaks volumes.
His testimony with respect to the shooting was, I aimed it at his leg. I'm just going to go through some of the things he said.
You don't have to do that, but I'm sure you have other arguments to make, but...
But this is important, and I want to address it. He said, I aimed at the victim's leg. I wanted to show him the gun to scare him, and I pulled the trigger out of rage. I wish he had left well enough alone and stayed out of my house. And then even when he's apologizing to the victim, he's never saying, why did you scare me? He's saying, why did you come back? Because he is mad that the victim broke into the home.
Well, I understand this. I think to suggest that in this kind of circumstance and many circumstances in which fear is at issue, I think that it'd be very rare to have someone say, I am afraid. I want you out of my house.
Even when he's discussing...
This is all after the fact. He's trying to reconstruct his state of mind. It's looking for those words.
But to some degree, are we stuck with what is in the record
yeah.
to inform what his state of mind is?
That's correct, Your Honor. And I think that you have him saying, I let my temper and my emotions get the best of me. This is at the time when he's trying to deflect culpability from himself. And he never says, he was coming at me. He apologizes profusely to the victim's brother.
That's a sufficiency argument. You're arguing the sufficiency. You're not addressing the scintilla standard. And the fact of somebody breaking into one's house at 10 o'clock at night, drunk, or at least intoxicated to some degree, loud, doesn't that introduce a scintilla of evidence that a rational homeowner would be concerned?
But he said he loaded the gun out of rage.
I'd be mad if somebody broke into my house, too, but I'd probably shoot him.
I quoted large sections of the victim's statements, and I try to stay away from doing large block quotes, but in this case, his own statements to the police, damn him. Over and over again, he says, I wanted to miss his leg, but I was shaking too bad. And he never says, I was shaking out of fear. He only says, I was shaking out of anger.
Okay, but I hear you. I credit what you're saying. Don't get me wrong. But I think you're leaving out reasonable inferences from the evidence. And I think they can be considered by a judge in determining whether a jury instruction should be given. The whole thrust of the jury instruction phase is to get something before the jury that they can chew on, if you will, and consider themselves. Yeah, you know, he wasn't afraid at all. You know, he said this, he said that. It's not an easy phase, I think, in a jury trial to get beyond this one.
Well, Your Honor, I'd note to the court that his whole argument was that he didn't intentionally pull the trigger. If that's the case, he can't be entitled to a self-defense instruction because that implies some sort of intentional act.
What about Mr. Greenspun's suggestion that essentially maybe he's just not a good shot? He's not necessarily aiming at him. And so he's just holding the gun to scare him, and the gun goes off. That's not necessarily inconsistent with a self-defense theory.
Well,
I understand your argument about the intentional act. I think what he's arguing is the factual scenario, not making it mutually exclusive.
So is the suggestion that the defendant fired was attempting to fire a warning shot and instead accidentally?
That's what I understand Mr. Greenspun's argument to be, which would not necessarily obviate whether it's sufficient evidence for the involuntary, but I think that is what their position is as it relates to the self-defense theory.
Your Honor, I would just come back to the suggestion that at the time he pointed the gun at the victim,
the standard one applies in addressing self-defense is not what that particular victim thought. It's what a reasonable person would think. The instruction says he reasonably feared under the circumstances as they appeared to him. So if a defendant, for instance, takes the witness stand and said, I was in fear of my life because I know this guy carries a gun, but the jury should determine that's not a reasonable fear, that's not a fear that a reasonable person might have, then self-defense fails. You're suggesting that we look at this through the eyes of the defendant.
Your Honor, I'd suggest to the court that there is some predicate. It's true that the defendant does not have to testify to be granted a self-defense instruction. But I think in this case where the defendant's testimony and his statements negate that fear, then he's not.
Did he say that he thought the victim was coming, had a gun in his hand, which turned out to be a cell phone?
Your Honor, I didn't see any evidence of that. That was Mr. Greenspun's argument, but I never saw any evidence, and I don't recall a citation to the record where that was what the defendant said.
Counsel, I'll grant you, I think that was, in fact, argument of Mr. Greenspun in reference to the gun. In fact, I don't think Mr. Lenau ever said that he saw a gun. But that aside, what are we to take in reference to this self-defense instruction as it relates to his comments when the victim's brother called and he indicates that he threatened us? I mean, is there any significance that we can import to that as it relates to the reasonable fear? And well, I understand that there's an argument going back and forth between the two brothers, but what do we make from that comment as it relates just to the scintilla part?
I'd suggest that there was no threat at the... One, I'd suggest, well, taking the evidence in the light most favorable to the defendant, yes, that is something to consider in terms of the self-defense...
Is that sort of the problem the Commonwealth may have is in reference to this matter is the standard of review when you're dealing with the jury instruction?
I don't think it's a problem for me, frankly, in this case, Your Honor, because at the time the defendant pointed the gun at the victim, he did. There was no in this in the even if he had testified that he. I'm sorry. Let me start over. Given these facts, a reasonable person would not have been afraid, would not have been in bodily fear because given what the victim said was, I just came to get my stuff. He never indicated that he intended to hurt the defendant. And in this case, you have the defendant's testimony over and over again a reasonable person having the information that the defendant had would recognize that the victim wasn't trying to hurt him. He just wanted to get his belongings.
Ms. Adelphia, what's your thoughts on whether a defendant can adopt inconsistent defenses at trial? I think self-defense and accident are clearly inconsistent. Self-defense is an intentional act, whereas accident is not. Can a defendant... say that, I wasn't there when the crime occurred, but if I was, I must have been insane?
I think you can. I don't know if it's a very good trial strategy, but but certainly a defendant can. Just like the Commonwealth can put forward different theories of guilt. And in this case, certainly the Commonwealth put forth multiple theories of guilt. And I just want to very briefly note that I want to just briefly turn to the first assignment of error, although... Unless the court has further questions with respect to the second. The first assignment of error was not preserved. Nowhere did Leneau or counsel argue that that there was insufficient evidence for involuntary manslaughter conviction because the Commonwealth had failed to prove that it was not an accident. We know from the case law that an accident
is required in reference to involuntary, and correct. I guess really what they're potentially getting at is the criminal negligence, which is not specifically presented.
That's correct. So that was waived, accident and criminal negligence are not mutually exclusive, and of course you can be criminally negligent and responsible for culpable for killing even if you killed them by accident. In this case, where the defendant aimed the gun at the victim and shot him, he acted with wanton recklessness. And then finally, with respect to the third assignment of error, I suggest that it was inappropriate. The trial court did not abuse its discretion in excluding evidence with respect to the defendant's criminal history or the actions of his family, because those matters were irrelevant to the defendant's culpability, and it would have been overly prejudicial given that their behavior did not actually touch upon the sorrow that they testified to with respect to their brother's, the victim's death.
What about the issue of bias on the part of the victim? The victim impact, the individual giving the victim impact testimony. There seemed to be some evidence that was proffered, at least. I don't know how else I would know it, that the family was beyond just being disturbed and troubled and saddened by the death, but really had some vindictiveness operating in their thought processes. But Mr. Greenspan was prevented from cross-examining on those issues, as I understand the record. What about that?
Your Honor, I see my time's expired. I'll just
answer
very quickly. I'd suggest to the court that given the... if there was any sort of error with respect to limiting the impeachment based on bias, it's just to the court that that error was harmless. It was clear that the victim, or excuse me, the sister was distraught. She was obviously biased against the defendant because she wanted to see him punished for the destruction he'd caused her family. So I think that any error in excluding that testimony would have been harmless.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
If it pleases the court, on the last question first, Mr. Lienau is serving in the Department of Corrections a 4-year sentence that may very well have been a 2-year sentence or something less, perhaps something more, but the jury was entitled to. What's happening in the bifurcated portion of cases where there's a guilty verdict, and this demonstrates it, is that the victim family member, the victim, gets on and gets to really realistically be able to say almost anything that they want to say. Defense is difficult to object in that situation. That happened here, and we knew and we had evidence that this family had effectively abandoned Mo, the deceased, that he had been in and out of jail, that this picture of him being this great employee at Sears and so on was not correct.
Where is the employment part specifically preserved in reference to that particular portion of the argument?
That she testified to.
No, I mean your objection to that.
I did not make a specific objection at that point because, well, I knew that he was in and out of jail and the employment was brief and so on. I don't believe that I said that specifically. But as far as all these other things, they're all throughout the argument on this sentencing phase issue. We had the records of his criminal history.
But your argument is that the bad character of the deceased is admissible at sentencing. And if I take that one step further, it almost sounds to me like my client shouldn't go to jail for as long because the defendant was a no good, or the victim was a no good bum.
No.
And I don't think we've ever, I mean, we have very limited admissibility of victim character evidence as to guilt or innocence. I don't know why we would allow that, why it would be relevant.
I agree with the court. It's like the old sage of you can't rape a hooker. That's wrong. Here, you can't trash a victim in a case just because it makes him look bad, and maybe the jury will take that into consideration. Here we have live witnesses who testified for a lengthy period of time about this being an A-plus young man, which by our proffers in the records was simply not true. So the rules of evidence continue to apply in the sentencing phase, and that was my brief point, is that it's becoming very fuzzy because the rules of evidence, given the nature of that, aren't being applied. The rules of cross-examination in this instance were not being applied, and we were precluded from letting the jury, because the victim is saying, I suffered, my family suffered this loss, and this is because this was this A-plus sibling.
But that was not admissible up until the passage of the Victim Rights Amendment to the Constitution and the enabling legislation.
That's right.
So that is specifically allowed now by constitution and by statute.
And the ability...
And the flip, the reverse is not true. The character of the deceased has not been made.
But the rules of evidence still apply here. It's not the character of the deceased. It's to impeach and to show the bias and the, frankly, the lies of that victim who is, sister, who is saying what a great young man he was.
I thought that was your issue. There is a legal issue with respect to the nature of the testimony you can elicit. You know, the victim was a bad guy. I thought it was the issue of not being allowed to cross-examine on bias and impeachment.
That's right. And
bias,
remember, these are the sisters who were involved in
that
the
you were
threats.
Prohibited from doing. Is that
that's
do
right.
I have the records?
Including about the Facebook threats to. I'm not even going to repeat what was said. It's in the record. So that was of great concern once there's a conviction. May I have just a few seconds more?
I'll give you 20 more seconds, Mr.
Well, Reinsdorf. I just want to clarify. There was reference to Mr. Lienau testifying, and in fact, he did not. He testified in the sentencing phase, but not in the guilt phase. Those were statements that he made to the police. I just want to clarify that in case I misled the court that way. As far as as Mr. Lienau's knowledge, he gave in his statements that he knew that J.R., this is Mo's brother, had a gun. And he didn't load the rifle until he came upstairs, turned the corner, and saw the door broken in, which you can see at pages 111 through 23, I think it is, of the door. That's when he loaded it.
Thank you.
I've pushed my limits.
Yes.